Wrapping up a very busy week, Friday, June 23rd, 2023, right here on Connecticut Today. We featured a chat with local law enforcement veteran and author Greg Dillon about his Connecticut Mirror op-ed regarding new state bail reform guidelines. We welcomed Avi Goldwasser, co-author of Betrayal, The Failure of American Jewish Leadership. And we also heard from former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso with his weekly thoughts. Return visit by this gentleman. We had him on, I think I look back in the show archives, last March, a year ago, this past March, to talk about his book, The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop Versus the FBI. And you probably have seen him all over Connecticut a lot of times at your local library or wherever you have lectures in your city or town. He's delivered quite a few talks about his book and his experience. He recently published an op-ed in the Connecticut Mirror, Bail Reform, Expect More Fugitives. And we've been talking about these bail changes in the state. Welcoming back Greg Dillon to WICC. Hey, Greg, it's Paul. How are you?
Great, Paul. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's good to have you on, Greg. It's been too long. I see you're doing well. I see stuff on your social media about your talks all over the state. Before we get to the issue at hand, how's that been going still, getting out there, talking to people, talking about your book and about the issues that are important to you?
Very well received. Thank you, Paul. I'm very happy with the feedback and response. The response has been very positive. People have been very supportive. Those who have read the book and those who plan on reading the book, and it's been enjoyable. I've had a good time getting around the state, seeing some of these different libraries that I've never been in before, and meeting people that I've never met.
So, Greg, you put this op-ed in the Connecticut Mirror, part of the CT Viewpoints series, Bail Reform, Expect More Fugitives. Now, you started your law enforcement career as a cop, and you worked your way up. What caused you to write this, Greg? And starting off here, what are some of your basic concerns here?
Well, my basic concern is the police departments currently are overwhelmed and understaffed, and this is only going to put an additional strain on their limited resources, because you're going to have more defendants that are now eligible to be released with less incentive to appear in court. And by bypassing a bail bondsman, at one time the bail bondsman or their staff would make an effort to try to locate the people that had absconded, the people that failed to appear in court.
Sure.
Without that safeguard in check, there is nobody really looking for these fugitives. You know, they've made a conscious decision to not appear in court, and it's not because they don't have enough vacation time saved up. You know, most of them aren't working people, and you don't have to be a criminal justice scholar to realize, if you just read newspaper articles, listen to the newspaper reports, when people are getting arrested, they're also being rearrested. So they're being arrested on whatever they got caught for, and they're being charged with all these additional outstanding charges: failure to appear, violation of probation, violation of parole, escape from a halfway house. And it's because they are already in a wanted status. So eliminating the bondsman just reduces one more opportunity for these people to be brought before a judge and make their court date.
So, Greg, before we take a break, how did this happen? What changed happen? What happened over the past couple of years that are causing this phenomenon you see to perhaps happen?
So traditionally, Paul, some of the bigger police departments would have their own, they would call them a warrant squad or warrant service or fugitive unit, whatever the name was. It was the same thing. There'd be a dedicated group of investigators that were tasked with going out and serving outstanding arrest warrants. These have been reduced and eliminated because the understaffing and something has to be cut, and that's usually one of the first things to be cut. In addition to the fact that the Chief State's Attorney's Office at one time had a standalone fugitive squad, which I was the supervisor of, that was eliminated. And now, there really is no one actively looking for these people. The only way they end up back in court is when they get rearrested. And traditionally, Paul, it's common sense. You know, people that have been arrested for robbery go out and continue to rob. Mm-hmm. Burglars burgle, thieves steal, drug dealers continue to sell drugs. They go right back to whatever it is that they have decided to make their criminal career out of. And we end up with more and more crime and less accountability. Yes, we're reducing the size of the prisons, but we are also now overwhelming the court system. We need more judges, we need more prosecutors, we need more public defenders, we need probation officers, parole officers. So I don't think we really save any money when we try to reduce the correctional institutions at the expense of having to increase all of the other systems that are supposed to be in place.
Greg Dillon is the guest, longtime law enforcement veteran, distinguished career at all levels of law enforcement. By the way, the name of Greg's book, we had him on to talk about that, The Thin Blue Lie, an Honest Cop versus the FBI. Greg, now concerned about changes in bail in the state, advocates calling it bail reform, and what's going to happen here. And Greg points out in a CT Viewpoints column at the Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org, Greg, I guess these changes were unanimously voted on at a recent meeting few weeks ago, Friday, June 9th, meeting of the Connecticut Superior Court judges. So when the judges vote on this stuff, Greg, is there no worry about the concerns that you brought up, or is this just an effort, Greg, to unclog the system or whatever? You tell me.
Well, I'm at a loss as to why they think it's a good idea, because it has the opposite effect, in my opinion. It clogs the system. Now there are more people that have outstanding arrest warrants. There's more paperwork involved. When they get rearrested, now they have even more charges that are pending. So I think it's a very short-sighted stopgap solution, but I think the consequences, the long-term consequences, are going to be, drastic.
Greg, you mentioned before the break something that I guess, and I've talked about it here on the show as well with these issues. There seems to be, Greg, this notion of no matter what the results, it's better to have fewer people being held behind bars. Let them go. Let them be with their families. We'll trust them to come back. Is that, Greg, in your opinion? I understand it would only be your opinion. Is that what's at work here, this notion that we just need to, for some reason, by some people's thinking, need to have fewer people being held for whatever reason?
I understand the thought process. I think it's wishful thinking, in my opinion. Statistically, that never seems to bear out. The people that are released are usually recidivists. They're repeat offenders. They're well known to the police. And as you can see, and as anyone who follows, any of the news stories, if you read the article to the end, after this person gets arrested, usually somewhere at the end of the article, you'll see that they were served with additional warrants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they opt not to attend court, and their decision-making process is sound because the odds are in their favor. They don't go to court. They continue to engage in a criminal lifestyle. And their thought is, I imagine, what's the worst that's going to happen to me? I get rearrested on a new case, and then they charge me on my old cases. So they're still out there, and they're still, committing their crimes. And Paul, I understand, the idea is like, well, we'll give them another bite of the apple. Well, we'll give them another bite of the apple.
Yeah.
The problem is they're eating our apple, right? It's when your catalytic converter gets stolen and you make an insurance claim, everyone's insurance rates go up. When somebody goes in and, shoplifts or steals all types of high-end merchandise from, drugstores and supermarkets, and whatnot, the loss of merchandise, those costs get put back on the consumer, right? The company's not going to take a loss. They're just going to increase their prices, and we're going to pay the difference. So my problem is, it is the law-abiding taxpayer that is having their apple eaten all the time when they continue to say, well, they should get another bite of the apple.
Greg, finally, you obviously must be, and I can tell by the tone of our talk today and by your column, it has to be really frustrating for somebody who was in law enforcement for as long as you have, even on the local police beat. And I can only imagine what policemen and policewomen do every day, putting their lives on the line to take some pretty bad guys and gals off of the streets, going with step one for public safety, and the frustration they must have. And I have heard from present day and past law enforcement officials to understand that they were back on the street the next day, or they were back on the street in 2 or 3 days. Especially, Greg, you see now with some of these rampant car thefts and these juvenile offenders who, I mean, there was one kid last week, Greg, who was jacking a car and wearing an ankle monitor from a previous arrest. I mean, that's got to be mind-numbing to men and women who work in law enforcement.
And his co-defendant was also wanted on outstanding charges, minus the ankle monitor, but also had previous outstanding warrants. So you're right. I mean, at some point, unfortunately, you know, the men and women of law enforcement get to the point where they just throw their hands in the air and say, this is ridiculous. It's catch and release, catch and release, catch and release. They know us. We know them. They have no fear of the consequences. And at some point, you know, the police officers decide this is not worth my time or effort. I don't want the liability. I don't want the danger. And I'm going to park my patrol car in some parking lot and just respond to 911 calls. And that will be it.
Greg, thank you. Of course, folks, always check out Greg's book wherever you get your books, Amazon, your local bookstore, whatever. They can order it for you. The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop Versus the FBI, his op-ed in the Connecticut Viewpoint section of the Mirror, Bail Reform, Expect More Fugitives. Greg Dillon's been with us. Greg, thank you. Take care, and we'll definitely be in touch. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, there you go. Fewer bail bondsmen getting involved, fewer bail agents. You know, and the notion is we're in this thing, this notion that we got in years ago is, well, you know, we need to have fewer people held in jail or behind bars. See, I think the opposite here. I think we need to have more people locked away. It's just me. Not that I don't like people. But look at the numbers. Our next guest is a former financial executive, board member of Jewish organizations, and film producer. Among his credits, the award-winning documentary, The Forgotten Refugees. He's gone together with Charles Jacobs for a new release here that is a collection of essays, Betrayal, The Failure of American Jewish Leadership. Avi Goldwasser joins us this afternoon on WICC on a Friday. Avi, good afternoon. It's Paul here. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you. So, Avi, you got together with a partner here. You came up with this. Now, this is a set of essays, correct? And explain what the book does here to our listeners, and why the need to do this, Avi. Why did you feel that this is timely?
Right. So Charles Jacobs and I have been fighting Jew hatred on college campuses for 20 years. And we realized that we cannot win the battle when the major Jewish organizations such as the ADL and the AJC are really not involved. They've abandoned Jewish students on campus. And we cannot do it without the resources of the Jewish community and the resources that they have. So what happened to fill the vacuum, smaller organizations such as the David Project, which Charles and I founded, and Stand With Us, and Camera, and ZOA, are fighting the battle on campus. But as long as the major organizations and the major resources of the Jewish community are not involved, we're not going to win. We're overwhelmed on campus, which is funded, a lot of the anti-Israel activities funded by Qatar and other Arab countries, and we're losing. Not to mention that the universities have been taken over by a progressive ideology, which is very hostile to Israel and Jews. So we decided that we need to expose the failure of Jewish organization, the established Jewish organization, their failure to really confront the growing hostility toward Jews. And as you know, in the last two decades, it's only gotten worse. Whatever they've been doing, especially the ADL, hasn't worked. And they keep repeating the same policy, the same strategy, which has failed in the past.
why
but doubling the effort, they'll get a different result.
Why, Avi, are they not stepping up? And I'm very passionate about this myself, Avi. This frosts me off like it does you and many other Jewish Americans and Jews all over the world. What is wrong with these major organizations? Are they simply afraid to speak up? Are they quivering in their boots? What's the problem?
Well, it's a great question, and I think you have to break it down. They're not afraid to speak up about neo-Nazis and white supremacists and the right-wing Jew hatred. Mm-hmm. They're very vocal about it. What they're afraid to speak up is any Jew hatred coming from progressives on campus, from Islamists, or from African-American. That's politically incorrect. That's the problem. And sadly, the growing hostility, certainly the physical attacks on Jews in the streets, have come mainly from African-American and Muslims, especially in New York City. And they're reluctant to deal with that because they're reluctant to describe minorities as in a bad light.
Avi Goldwasser is the guest. He's gotten together with Charles Jacobs to curate a collection of essays, now in the book Betrayal, The Failure of American Jewish Leadership. Get it at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books. Avi, I've talked to several Jewish political scholars over my years of doing shows like this, and they've all had interesting theories on this as to the prevalence of anti-Semitism reflective of perhaps, and you talked about the far-left progressivism, Avi, of how the branches of American Judaism tend to vote. The Reform voting one way, conservative and Orthodox are generally more to the right. Do you draw any parallels in your own mind with that or not? Because I do know that, you know, a lot of, at least, progressive Jews in the U.S. tend to favor, you know, some of these groups that are not stepping up and protecting Jews.
Yeah, I think that certainly the leadership of the Jewish community has been what people would consider progressive, liberal, and they tend to, I believe, have some utopian notions about human nature. And they tend to be very sensitive to minorities who've been in the past oppressed and so forth. And I think it's very generous, and I think the Jewish community has been very generous toward those minorities, all kinds, whether it's blacks or gays or women. And I think it's something that is noble. However, the problem is that Jews are no longer as safe as they were 20, 30 years ago. The situation has changed, and the leadership has refused to accept the sad and ugly fact that the left, which has been a friend of the Jews for hundreds of years, has abandoned the Jewish community, has betrayed the Jewish community. And that's painful to Jews who consider themselves part of the left. Mm-hmm. They're not reconciled to that situation. And they tend to be, I think in denial. And therefore, I'm reluctant to deal with the reality of the current situation, which is different than historical anti-Semitism in the last 400 years. And that's the problem. They're in denial of the new reality.
Yeah.
They fail to understand the new threats, okay? And they fail to understand human nature. Jews believe that if we are nice to them, they'll be nice to us. Jews have done an enormous amount of campaigning and supports to the black community, they did not get much reciprocity.
Avi, back to something you mentioned before we took the break here, what goes on college campuses. And I'm shocked, and I talk about it a lot on this program here locally in Connecticut, Avi, about some of the stuff that you mentioned on college campuses, the blatant racism and anti-Semitism. You know, I'll be frankly from, and let's be frank here, you've got 19, 20, 21-year-olds who, frankly, Avi, with all due respect, don't know their rear ends from a hole in the ground here. And they think now, because somebody told them something about the history of Jews and anti-Semitism in the Middle East, you know, they think they know it all. That has to be maddening to people like you and people who have written essays that you've curated here.
Yeah, look, I spent 20 years fighting on campus. I've made several films about it. The most recent one is called Hate Spaces, which describe what's going on college campuses and the fact that the major Jewish organizations and the college administrators and college professors are ignoring it. No minority would tolerate the behavior toward Jews that is they experience on campus. And Jews, for some reason, Jewish leadership is willing to tolerate it. It's hard to explain. Now, there's certainly an element of cowardness there. Mm-hmm. There's certainly an element of sort of utopian thinking. And there's a reluctance, as I said, to attack other minorities when they behave badly. And so the book is really about pointing out that the Jewish leadership has failed to do its fiduciary job. They're very busy helping everybody else, but not really supporting Jews on campus and Jews who are being attacked.
So,
and it's a matter of cowardness to some extent and just confused thinking.
So, Avi, how does that change? How do you and the people who've written these essays that you've put together, how do you change that? And how long would it take to make appreciable change there?
Well, it's hard to predict how long anything takes to change. But we know that in the Jewish community, it's the donors who anoint the leaders. The leaders are not elected. And therefore, it's the donors who can change things. They need to be educated. They need to be shamed. They need to be held accountable for their failure. And that's what we're trying to do. I think the essay is just documentation. It's an indictment of the failed Jewish leadership, including the donors. Now, we hope that raising awareness is the first step toward change. Sadly, usually change happens after some traumatic event.
Mm.
All right? So how many Jews have to be beaten up before somebody realizes that whatever we're doing to stop Jew hatred is not working, and we should try doing different things?
Avi,
You don't get punished for attacking Jews. You don't get punished for demonizing Jews.
No, you don't.
The way you would. And what we ask, what we demand, is attacks on Jews be treated the same way as attacks on blacks or gays or any other minority. We want equal treatment.
Absolutely. The name of the book, it's a collection of essays from famous Jewish scholars, columnists, and authors, Betrayal, The Failure of American Jewish Leadership. Avi Goldwasser has been the guest. He has curated that along with Charles Jacobs. Avi, thank you. Good luck with this book, and hopefully we can speak down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate inviting me.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Avi Goldwasser, GoldWasser. He of the Jewish Leadership Project, the name of the group, Betrayal, The Failure of American Jewish Leadership. And again, it's a collection of essays from people who are writing on this subject and how, especially on college campuses, folks. I mean, this is, you don't have to believe me. Just look it up. The amount of pure hatred and anti-Semitism out there. And he's right. A lot of the big Jewish organizations and the college administrators, they quiver in fear about calling this out right now for his weekly check-in as we head to the weekend, and he will help you cleanse your minds of all dastardly thoughts. Chris Caruso is here. You're like, I got to build you up some way, man. I mean, come on.
I'll tell you, those dastardly thoughts,
you know,
are a way to do it, Paul.
All those thoughts of just people yelling and screaming at each other from Monday to Thursday. But Friday, Chris, we put on our herb tea, our crumpets. We all sing Kumbaya. That's
right.
That's it.
Yeah, do a little yoga, and we're ready for the weekend,
that's
right?
That's it. I have a woman friend of mine in radio who literally, you know when they do that yoga thing where you stand on your head for some reason?
Yes,
she does that,
I've
like
heard of it.
She does that like every day.
God bless her.
See,
I fall over. That's
well,
for
yeah,
sure.
She hits her head. Yeah. She stands on her head. I hit my head. That's how it works. Anyway,
well,
Mr.
Yes.
Caruso, what's on your mind this week?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Bridgeport first. I got a call today from a good friend. Eric is his name. He's a big supporter of Bridgeport. He lived, as a matter of fact, in the apartments downtown right next to Bijou Theater on Fairfield Avenue. Mm-hmm. They were new developments, and he lived there for a while. Just a big supporter. And he mentioned to me about the largest property in the city of Bridgeport, residential property in the city of Bridgeport, is in Black Rock, 15,000 square feet of property. And it's a huge house. And it was built, from what I understand, by a seafaring captain, because Bridgeport, especially in the Black Rock area, had a lot of those captains that came in from sea and built structures. It later became an academy for nautical students to learn. And then Ruger, who was one of the owners of the Ruger company, he purchased it. And now it's up for sale for $3.9 million.
I saw that. Yeah.
And it overlooks Long Island Sound. And it's just another one of those gems that Bridgeport has. It's on Old Battery Road in Black Rock. And you take that and you look at Seaside Park, where 365 acres, Paul, right on Long Island Sound, that P.T. Barnum will to the city. Mm-hmm. And then Beardsley Park, that was given by Beardsley, a businessman, a farmer, Beardsley Park plus the zoo. And, you know, this weekend, spend some time at some of those spots. Maybe drive by that house and take a look at it. There's a proposal apparently coming down the road that they want to subdivide the property and build other houses around it, which will really take away from the architectural beauty of that building and the historical beauty of it. But Bridgeport's a great spot to visit on the weekend, and hopefully people will take advantage of that. And I just want to throw that out there. I can't believe $3.9 million, such a beautiful building in Bridgeport.
Well, did you put your bid in yet, Chris? I mean, come on. You got to step up.
I did. You know, I went through the couch and made sure it collected any coins I had or anything like that.
Couch change,
I'm still counting it all, you know?
Yeah. What else on your mind, Chris?
Well, a big thing that's going on that I thought was the implementer bill, which was the budget that you've talked about before.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I just want to say it's not only Democrats that do it. Republicans now do it as well. The latest implementer bill is a freshman legislator. It just came into the legislature. Pizzuto was his name out of Middlebury.
Yep.
And they put in an implementer that it overrides local zoning regulations when it comes to a warehouse that's being proposed for the town.
Yeah.
So, it's often the Republicans yell that home rule and local zoning should rule, and here they're putting things in the implementer bill. So,
yeah, I saw
the implementer bill.
I saw that. And Chris, why is that? I mean, my obvious question would be, and maybe the answer is because they can, but do other states have these implementer bills? In other words, the keys to the car? I mean, do other states do this or not?
You know, Paul, I'm sure they do. I'm sure there's some states that do. It's just a way in Connecticut, when you get down to the last minute, the last days of session, how do you get those bills in that didn't pass muster through the committee process? In this case, though, the state representative, being a freshman, had no juice at all in this process, and it had to be the leadership that approved it. So it came in through the leaders of the Republican caucus, and the Democrats agreed because they wanted a budget, and they came along with this. And so a lot of things get in there. You know, all my years, I never got anything into the implementer bill unless it was, you know, valid legislation, and I don't even recall off the top of my head that anything that comes to memory. But it's gotten to a point now, everything goes in there. And I think that problematic in some ways, because, you know, some issues that get a fair process and go through the process that probably shouldn't be included is included. And it's happening to both sides. Stanford, for example, also got something in the implementer, again, to override local zoning. It's another tool. I think the mayor of that town said that can be used by that local zoning board. I just think, you know, you can on one breath say home rule and that local municipalities have the right to govern themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put something in the implementer that kind of null and voids that process. So I thought that was interesting. I wanted to throw it out there in fairness.
Sure.
Both sides do it, but now you're seeing more of some really standard foundational issues that Republicans have: protect home rule, protect local zoning, and now these things go into it.
Yeah.
And another issue. Yep. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Again.
Yeah. The other issue I wanted to talk about was the submarine and the implosion of the submarine that took place. I guess I'm a little superstitious, and as I get older, it gets a little worse. But that's a graveyard. You know, the Titanic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Over 1,500 bodies. It's a graveyard. It shouldn't be touched. It shouldn't be defaced or anything done. It's as if you walk through a cemetery. frankly, and did something. And this was similar. And interesting enough, they got 1,500 feet to the hull of the Titanic, and then apparently the submarine imploded.
Yeah.
And it's a sad commentary. I hate to see people die that way. But again, I always get the heebie-jeebies and say I don't want to get too close to situations like that, you know?
Yeah, and again, Chris, I kind of agree with you there. Now, I'm not a big water guy. I probably wouldn't drown if you dropped me in the ocean, and I have gone on cruises and done a little touristy submarine. It was a regular sub, but we only went down about 100, 150 feet, and we saw some really cool stuff, and we surfaced, but... You know, Chris, and whether it's this, and I talked about it earlier, or you buy a seat on, say, the Jeff Bezos thing, Blue Origins, like William Shatner did, which, if given the choice, I would do that in a heartbeat. But it must be, and you know, this stuff is expensive. But you know, Chris, I guess when you are a billionaire or have several billion dollars. And money literally is no object. You could live on the interest. You could live on an hour's worth of interest. I guess this is what people do to maybe be that explorer that they always wanted to be when they were a kid, and they have the means to do it, you know?
You know, I think you have a point. And some of these millionaires throw money around like quarters, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the situation. But what was so fascinating... You know, here are people that are millionaires that work to invest their money, to grow their money, and yet they invest in a company that had a shaky record at best. You know, the submarine was being controlled by a joystick, I think, in video games.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm.
And there was no tracking devices, all of the different things that you think should be there. On top of it, Paul, the submarine was going, 12,000 feet down, you know, to the sea floor.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our U.S. submarines go about 6,000.
No, they can't.
So, I would think the pressure would be part of the implosion. But again, you know, I think people that go down there and try to take dishes and bottles and shouldn't do that. You know, it's a graveyard and should be respected, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Caruso, thank you as always. Have a great weekend. We'll check with you next week. Thanks.
Okay, Paul.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you. Yeah, I saw an interesting about a 3 or 4 minute interview with James Cameron, the movie director. I guess what, Avatar 2 is out now, and Avatar 3 is coming up next year, and he, of course, brought back kind of the mystique of the Titanic with that movie way back with a very young Leo DiCaprio. But listen, he has also developed a career as a deep sea diving specialist. I mean, he's been to how deep is the Mariana Trench? 32,000 feet. Oh. And he's made it down there, and he made it down and back. But again, he mentioned in this interview the money he spent and the testing and the technical specs. I mean, he said just the computer modeling took a year or two just to get that right. So it is what it is, and I'm sure those souls who were lost and hopefully went on to something better in the afterlife, they knew about it. They ended up signing this legal release that mentioned death, they say, at least three times in there. Wow. Thank you, Chris.